Hey, everybody. We're here live, Pinecone Studios, New John Simmons Show. I'm here with Dr. Steve McCullough. Steve, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you, sir?
Doing so excited to have you on the program, man. This is just a conversation between friends here. I mean, we're at Pinecone Studios. You see the Pinecone here?
That's what I'm talking about.
We talk about just whatever God's doing in your life and also hear the testimonies and everything else. So this is
awesome.
Pretty free flowing, man. So tell me a little bit about Dr. Steve.
So I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay.
And I moved here in 2011 and had a long history of medicine and wound up getting accepted over to WashU. And then that brought me to St. Louis. And so from there, my track was to go into med school, but I decided to go to a PhD program.
Okay.
And so I took a different route there, but that's what got me here into St. Louis.
Cincinnati. So you're not a St. Louisan, so you're not from the St. Louis Proud. You're from Cincy and Proud. What do they say up there?
That's correct. Well, I mean, it's just we're from the Natty.
I got it. That's not a term I've heard before. Okay, so I'm with you, though. I'm flowing here. So you born and raised there?
Born and raised.
And so what draws somebody into medicine? What was it that for you?
Oh, man. So I tell people this funny story all the time. So my brother, I always wanted to go into sports med. And my big brother, David, he was playing football and he broke his big toe.
Yeah.
And they pulled him over to the sideline and Coach Oliger, rest in peace, phenomenal coach. Coach Oliger, back then, they could do this. Now you go to jail.
Uh-oh.
But he took his big toe and twisted it, popped it back in. And as little brother, I'm on the sideline just looking like, what are you doing to my big brother? You know?
Yeah.
And I thought it was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And from there, that started the journey. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, so that's what's
bring your mic a little bit closer to your mouth for me. And so that's interesting. So see, I get sort of squeamish around that kind of stuff, but not you, huh?
No, not at all. Not at all. It took me to the military. I did. I was a Navy corpsman with the Marines and just absolutely loved my time with my Marines.
So hold on. So you got inspired by a football injury or sports injury,
okay.
And then you decided to go into the military?
Correct. So I did. I did. I played football, went on football scholarship myself, and then between schools, I wound up going into the Navy. And when I was in the Navy, I was a corpsman, and I had an option to go with the Marines. So my goal totally was to go into sports medicine still,
yeah.
But to get that experience. And so when I went into the military, I volunteered for a mission trip overseas, and I went to Indonesia, and we did a humanitarian mission trip, my first one, and it changed my life. And I wanted to do global health after that. So it took me from sports medicine to now looking at global health. So yeah. It's been a transition, and I still do humanitarian missions, but it's been a transition period through medicine.
Wow, this is I'm very interested in the medicine side of your story because I don't have a lot of people on who walk in that world, but it must take a strong upbringing to sort of get you excited for that kind of like book heavy, class heavy, studying and doing all that sorts of things. So like, what was your upbringing like that prepared you to step out like that?
Man, my family just phenomenal. We had so much love. We were rich in love, you know.
Yeah.
We weren't the wealthiest, but we were definitely rich in love. And my parents, my dad's Sunday school teacher, and just one of the most phenomenal teachers you've ever met. And so watching him study and then watching my mom, they didn't play when it came to academics. So we always had the academics there. We would study at home. We would play, you know, educational games at home. My mom would always make it fun. And so we grew up in an environment to where, because my parents didn't have, they made sure that we had. And so they enforced academics strongly in our house.
Yeah. See, now for me, it was like not a real big deal, you know? And so I find that interesting. Like, my parents wanted me to get good grades, you know, and I was the type of student, I was like, what's the way to describe it? So I was advanced in my mental cognitive ability. So like I was in advanced programs if I could test into them.
Gotcha.
But when I was in the classes, I wasn't like a person who was like, let's open this book up and let's go after it. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I was a person who could like understand what's happening. You know, but I was not a person who wanted to study and go after it. So I would not necessarily get good grades, but I would constantly over and over again excel in all sorts of areas where I was testing, right?
Natural ability.
Yes. And so they put me in a gifted program and then almost skipped me a grade in seventh grade. And I graduated when I was 17 years old, real young. And I mean,
man.
But school didn't mean nothing to me, though. It wasn't a thing that my parents were ever like, you know what, you really need to focus on that. And so I take for granted now that I'm about to turn 40 and what I'm what I would like to see my kids do. Like, you need to do good in school. It's a basis for your foundation. And like, talk about what like your parents would probably talk to you about, right?
Yeah. So my dad grew up in Cabrini Green in Chicago, which is one of the worst projects in the history of this country.
That's what's that movie that that's about? Well, the Candyman, right?
Yeah, Candyman.
Yeah.
But matter of fact, an interesting thing is there's a movie about called Cooley High, and he actually went to Cooley High.
Oh, wow, so, wow, wow. Yeah.
And then he wound up moving to Cincinnati, where it was a little bit safer, you know, but he grew up in Chicago, so he's a Chicago native. And then my mom grew up in Paris, Kentucky. And so my family, they didn't have a strong academic background. So when it came down to them raising us, they were just like, no, because we didn't have it, we're going to make sure that our kids have it.
Yeah, that's really neat, because a lot of parents, like, I don't know if they look at it like that. And I don't know if it's like a Christian thing. Were your parents Christian?
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, so you were raised in a church. And
most
raised...
definitely. Most definitely. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're Pentecostal. So we,
oh, okay. All right.
So we had, you know.
Like AG or Pentecostal. Either one is probably.
Yeah, PAW Pentecostal.
Okay.
And phenomenal upbringing in church. But we had Monday night was young people service. Tuesday
Pentecostals
night
are there.
Was prayer. Wednesday night, Bible study. Thursday night.
My kids go to Pentecostal school. And my grandma grew up in AG church. So I like, if you in that church, you at church.
You in there.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You might take Thursday off, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we'll see you there.
Yeah. And then Zanesville, we had Bible camp during the summertime. I mean, using the word, you know, using the word. But the great thing about it is, I'll say this, is that Sunday school was the most phenomenal thing for us, because we had some, like Sister Gunnels, if you memorized, I think it was all the books of the Bible, she gave you a literally, it's probably a foot long chocolate chip cookie.
Uh-huh.
And then for the next level, Sister Viola, she would give, Sister, they would give you a Bible. So you had incentives to know the word. And I ain't talking about cheap incentives. Like, you got your own Bible.
Yeah.
And that was like the coolest thing, you know, in church.
I got $100 bill that I have for my kids. I'm like, first one of y'all to come home and say what these 66 books are in order, you get this $100 bill. And I was like, I told them young. I was like, this may take you 5-10 years. I don't know, but it's here today. Like, it's here today. Yeah. So it's interesting that you say like the Bible is the reward. Sometimes for these kids, it's just a piece of chocolate. It'll help.
That's it. That's what we had, the chocolate chip cookie. Everybody want that cookie. Yeah. It make you sick though, 'cause you try to eat the whole thing.
Oh yeah. Just like the Coca-Cola. It's a, so you got a good upbringing. You're in church all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You're inspired to go into medicine. Yeah. And it was it really just seeing your brother's toe broken? Or was there something, like, what do you think caused that?
Medicine itself, a lot of times people go into medicine because of an experience that they've had. The toe breaking and seeing it been put back in, that geared me toward what type of medicine. So I wanted to go into physical therapy. I wanted to go into sports med from there.
Okay.
Because I was an athlete myself. And so part of that was the specifics in the avenue, but medicine in itself is about caring people.
Yeah.
My pastor used to tell me a lot of time before that I was a part of a ministry of helps. So I've always, since I was a young kid, wanted to help people. And that's always been my life. And that's, it just geared me towards medicine.
Yeah. Did you ever do any of those like motivational gifts testing, or did you score high in mercy and things like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was all the giving part of it. The caring parts, I would always score out of the box on those.
Yeah. See, now I am like, if there was an opposite of gifting, of the mercy gift, like I'm on the other, we study and teach, at the ministry, a book called, Discover Your God-Given Gifts by Don and Katie Fortune.
Okay.
You're familiar with it? Oh. I don't know. But, they interviewed 500,000 people to write this book. This was in the 70s, Christians, and came up with like a 20 question quiz, essentially, to, for each of the seven gifts you find in Romans 12. And so there's giving, teacher, server, you know, administrator, perceiver, etc. And so we take and teach this test. And so we found out that mercy, you know, is the number one gift given to most people. You know, like 35% of the world runs in this mercy gift.
I wish they'd use it.
Yeah, right. Tell me about it. And so I don't have a lot of people in my life that walk in that gift, though, until I had my third kid. And you saw it today. So when you walked in the house, she's giving you a hug. She's like, how you doing? What are you doing? Yeah. What are you up to? Yeah. And it's a different personality. And so I can tell Now, and having started teaching class, and I see more people who actively walk in their giftings, how important the mercy gift is. And it's really something that is innate in us that God has given people to walk in. So I imagine there's a lot of doctors, nurses, and like my wife has, it's her secondary gift is mercy. And that's why she's a nurse, you know? And so she's wanted to be a nurse since she was 5 years old. She doesn't even know why she wants to be a nurse, but she just wants to help people, right? So for you, the sports medicine side of it, what was it? What was the attraction of that specifically? Because it explain sports medicine a little bit to me.
So sports medicine, as an athlete, I was a football player and I ran track, and God blessed me to play at every level. I had a real short stint at the pro level.
Oh yeah.
With the Edmonton Eskimos.
Oh, come on, Eskimos.
That was a phenomenal Canada. Experience there. But with looking at medicine itself, it was a matter of just really understanding how as an athlete I can get better. Because it was not so much being on the field, but off the field, taking care of your body. And so sports medicine itself, everything from orthopedics to your bones and the study of your bones and how, for instance, we had a cement track in high school.
Yeah.
And even though we went state every single year, we still wound up with shin splints, back aches, and everything else from running on cement with lines painted on it.
Oh, wow.
So looking at that and all the injuries that I had, I was always in the hospital for something, broken bone.
You probably didn't know though. I mean, as a kid, it was because of the cement though, right?
Yeah, all that played a major part in it, you know, and the pounding and then transitioning from sport to sport to sport. Cause I was a three sport athlete. So it was just literally from football season to basketball season to track season.
Yeah.
And your body takes a toll even at that young age. And so even now I can feel those injuries,
cramps and all that.
Yeah. But the thing about it for me, being in those hospitals and being in those sports medicine clinic, my mom would always tell the story that I wasn't a bad kid. I was just inquisitive. She could tell my two brothers to sit there, but she would tell me to stay in the area.
Yeah.
Because I was always looking at those Norman Rockwell pictures that you see in those medical clinics. And I would always find it amazing. Next, you know, I'm in the back of the clinic, but I'm still looking at the paintings, not getting in trouble, but I just wanted to find out what was going on. And that's the kind of kid I was.
Man, sports medicine. So it's an interesting road that you're telling me that you walk though, because as a young kid, you're an athlete, but yet this mission trip calls on you.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it really had a big impact on you. It does not add up though. If you're looking at it from the outside, if I'm just reading your story, like athlete, sports medicine, missionary trip. How's this come about?
So let me take you to Indonesia.
Okay.
So our mission was, I went to optician school in the Navy. And so our mission, they wanted us to go in and make glasses and in the middle of the jungle. So literally we take all our equipment in. We had one team that was doing ocular surgeries. And then we had another team, which I was part of, the opticians, where we would make the glasses. So our joint mission there in the jungle, imagine going out the first day you get there and you're setting up your equipment. So they had this like little tiny school, probably about three classrooms. That's how big it was.
Yeah.
And we set up all our equipment in there. That was the first night. Now, hardly nobody's there. You come back the next morning, you have 5,000 people out there. Literally. And they walked all night long to get there because it was free healthcare. Now, two stories real quick. The first one was the kids. So they told us to bring candy. So I brought a bag of Starburst. I remember this little kid came up to the window, and I got a picture of him too. I wish I brought it. But he grabbed the candy. And he said, "Terima kasih," which means thank you in Indonesia. And he disappeared. And I'm looking at my coworker, Mark, and he's like, "Where'd he go?" I was like, "I don't know." Man, about 5 minutes later, he come back with 10 more kids.
Uh-oh, yeah. He's brought the buddies.
Exactly.
And he's got Jerry. You know, he might have some strawberries left.
Exactly. So the other one, which really gave me an understanding of how important what we were doing, we got shot at while we were over there. Something happened, undisclosed in the military mission. But we got shot and we had to pack up probably about 3 weeks prior to when we were supposed to leave. So while we were doing that, we had to close shop at a certain time when our commander came in and said it's time to go. But I remember this father, he grabbed his daughter and he picked her up. And from our door, we were making glasses. There was probably about, I'm gonna say 5 feet. He took his 13-year-old daughter and he threw her into our office. He literally threw her in there because he wanted her to get a pair of glasses before we left. I made her three before we left. And I'm just like, for a father to do that, you know, he was just like, "I need you to take care of my dad." Not for himself. He did that for his daughter. So I was just like, "I'll take care of her. I got you."
This story, for one, it's touching right to your heart. But second, like the imagery of it is so biblical, you know, from the idea of like, you guys show up to help. And imagine Jesus shows up. And like the first day, you're just the guy in the field, right? Man. You're just the guy in the field who gets touched, right? But you run off and you're like, dude, this guy's here.
He's healing folk.
And 5,000 people show up, right? Imagine how over. So you got to sort of, you, in a way, you got to experience what that felt like.
Yes.
You know, in that season for Jesus, right? It was like empty field, full field.
Yeah.
We're here.
It was called a medical trip, but that's ministry.
Yeah, of course.
That's exactly ministry. And being able to go into a place. Now, let me clarify this, because some folks always ask this question. Why not do it here in the U.S.? And what I tell the folks a lot of times is God has a call on each person's lives. There are some people who are called to help locally. There are some people who are called to help globally. It has always been on my heart to go globally. And so that's where I studied. My master's is in global health. Even my doctorate is in international policy. And so that, for me, the call on my life is to go globally. And at some point, I'll be, you know, heading back to do a lot of that more.
Well, so not only did this big crowd of people show up, but this man, this husband, this father, you know, he rolls up and he's like, they're leaving. The chopper's going up. We got to get the kid up over there. And he runs the baby into the...
And through her. Yeah, she hit the floor, rolled all the way to the back of her.
But you're like, look, these bruises will heal.
Yes.
But you're going to get, like, you're going to be able to see for the next 10 years because of this.
Yeah.
That is like taking your friends to Jesus, putting them through.
And lower them.
Yeah,
that,
it's exactly what it looks like.
Yes.
And it looks like people are still like that today. When help comes, when Jesus shows up, and Jesus can show up through an optometrist in the middle of Indonesia.
That's right.
You know, when people recognize that help is there. Man, those produce the best stories. And Jesus, of course, is the best help, and he helps in every situation.
Yeah. But we have to be willing to use our gifting to be that opportunity. Because a lot of folks, you know, especially in church, they'll just be like, you know, I pray the Lord's going to bring somebody.
Yeah.
It's like, knucklehead, look in the mirror. He brought you.
I'm here. Yeah, that's so funny. The church world, I know you wrote a book about it. We're going to talk about this book here, guys, everybody. We're going to put the link in the description. Let's talk business, teaching, and training in churches specifically. So a lot to cover there. But I want to finish wrapping up your story. So let's talk about what happens that pulls you. Were you in the Army a long time?
No, so I did 3 years, almost a half year. And then I had an opportunity to get out and go back to school. So I got into a scholarship, and then I was able to go back to school and finish up playing football. And then at that point, it was such a blessing because I had done medicine already and I had done surgeries already. So now I'm going back to the classroom, and it was a blessing that it happened, because if I would have read those books prior to doing that, it probably wouldn't have made as much sense. But now when I'm reading anatomy, physiology, because of my experience, Navy corpsmen are the best prepared medics in the entire world. The training that they give us is world class. And any country that knows about the United States military, they know that the corpsmen are the best trained.
Yeah.
And so it's an honor to be a corpsman and stand among that group and have that type of training.
Yeah, it reminds me of the scripture that says, you know, like man's heart plans his way, God guides his steps.
Yes.
For you, you have this, you know, vision of doing sports medicine in your life. Little did you know that the trip to the military was going to be the big part or a big piece of a puzzle that was going to lead you further in life.
Yes.
So you end up in school. Where'd you go to school at?
So I went to Miami of Ohio. And so when I was at Miami, Ohio, studied athletic training. So I'm still kind of butting my head of, let me go back to sports medicine, you know?
Yeah.
And so at that point, there were some things that occurred that really helped me again to steer my path. And so I had an opportunity to go try out for the Eskimos at that point. Met my trainer, Richard Carey, in Cincinnati. He used to play for the Bengals, matter of fact.
Okay.
He's a minister.
All right.
And it was such a blessing to go into a gym and train and hear gospel music.
Oh, yeah.
And anytime, you know, personal trainers world in Cincinnati, Ohio, he trains professional athletes. And anytime I have an opportunity to speak about the gifting that God has placed on him to make his stand to be a Christian business, you know, and come in that environment and still hear the word being pronounced and see it on the walls, man, it's phenomenal.
So the Eskimos, how long was that stint?
So that was a very, very short stint.
Yeah, okay.
So my agent, he was just like, hey man, you did well in the tryout. So imagine going to tryout, there's probably about 1,000 people there. They're making cuts. It's like a 5-hour tryout. Cause when you get on the team, you know, you gotta be ready to play cause the season's starting pretty soon. And so they was just like, yeah, they want to talk to you. Everything's great and everything else. And so then finally he calls me up about 2 weeks later and he was like, well, they just cut you because a guy from the Chicago Bears got picked up. I was like, oh, man.
Oh, they're so close to Cincinnati.
So, right. So, but we had a conversation and he said, do you want to continue on?
Yeah.
Or do you want to go, you know, to the med school route? Because we had talked about that. And I said, man, I'm not going to be chasing team after team after team. That's it. I don't think that's the call that God has on my life right now. It's time to head back to school.
Yeah.
And so I made that decision to head on back to school and then finish up and went straight through MBA, a master's of public health and MBA, and then right into a doctorate program.
That's a lot of school.
It's a lot of school. But for the MPH program, shout out to Wright State University. They came in with one class left and they said, if you do 9 more classes, we'll give you an MBA. And I said, I'm not passing that up. So that's the only reason why I have two masters.
Hey, it's all right. We all, hey, you could share one. I don't have any. So, so you get your master's and your doctorate. And so, but you said it's more on the other side.
Correct. The yep. administration side.
Administration side. Correct. Yeah. So, did you see yourself going in that direction?
No. Literally one thing occurred. I was in a hospital working and I heard this physician cussing this nurse out. And he was going in on her, literally to a point where another nurse had to come out and shield her from this physician. And that at that point, that was literally a thing for me to go on the administrative side to make sure that I don't ever see that again. My job administratively is to protect all staff, to make sure that, you know, especially my wife's a nurse, 37 years. And so making sure that not only the nurses, but my physicians as well, too.
Yeah.
But then all staff are treated fairly and equally, and that's so important in our medical field. I don't care how many degrees I have behind my name, you know, it doesn't make me better than anybody else. You know, we still treat each other with respect.
Yeah, that's interesting because my wife is a nurse, and so she started nursing like the week before we met. So I've known about her entire career. I was there the whole moment of it. And so what she realized pretty early on is like, you know, a standard nurse, right? So 12-hour shifts, you know, switching floors, you know, not really knowing which day-to-day what kind of patients she'd be working with, right? So, and so she realized pretty early on that, like, the rules that were coming down, like patient care and different things, were different than what needed to be taking place.
Yes.
You know, and so she had a shift in her heart. And like we talked about, like writing God's sentence for our life all the time. Like, what is God's plans for our life? And I was like, maybe your plan from God is to, because you notice this, like there's a reason you're noticing this and no one else is really noticing this, is for you to make those kinds of changes, you know? And so I was like, maybe you need to sort of switch into this administration side of things. And she was reluctant at first. I was like, well, go back to school and be a nurse practitioner, do something that can get you at a elevated level. And she's like, well, I don't really want to go back to school. I was like, well, you need to pray and ask God how to open up these doors for you if you're not going to go back to school. And so she prayed, we both prayed, God show us. And all of a sudden she gets this offer to go work at, and you just told me that your wife works at a nursing facility. Yeah. Yeah, so she gets a call to work in a nursing facility, and a 1-star nursing facility, but she got a promotion, and so she's got a promotion to work here. It's like the worst year of her life, Steve, I'm telling you. She said that like there wasn't enough people for all the patients they had.
It's a lot.
Yeah. And there's a lot on people's shoulders.
It is.
And so she came home crying a lot. Yeah. You know, because she has this mercy gift, she had this heart to care for people, and it's like,
yeah,
I'm having a hard time. And at that point she's overseeing the nurses who are doing the work, you know. Okay. So anyway, so she eventually gets a call from the original hospital that she worked at to get promoted to another level where she's a nurse manager essentially over at SSM where she works now. And so they said because of her experience at NHC she can have this job, which catapulted over all her friends that she knew who had also applied for this job because of the prayer that we put in, the belief that we had. She didn't have to go get a master. She didn't have to go get these other things that they were looking for initially because she had on the job experience crying for a year at this NHC.
Beautiful, make room for
right.
it.
Right. And that's what I'm talking about, is because the plan that she had 6 or 7 years ago to be in a position to help people who aren't getting the right care that they need, she's now put herself in a much better position overseeing the nurses who are extending that care. And now her vision is to go even further than that, so she can be a person in a seat like you are now to be able to do effective care from the other side, not just patient care, but we're looking out for the people who are involved. We're making the decisions that help the patients have better treatment.
I have to protect both sides. And on the clinical side, you know, of course you want to protect the patient, but also protect the staff as well too. Because there's some patients who come in who attack staff and everything else. And
oh, yeah.
I wish there was more laws in place.
I don't think a lot of people know that.
They don't. And we have to do a better job of protecting our clinicians. You know, I don't need my physicians and my nurses coming to work to be afraid to get hit, things thrown at them and everything else. I understand people are sick, but no one goes to work to get abused.
Yeah.
So there needs to be more protection.
The first time she told me a story about like that healthcare has like guards essentially, or like people
sometimes
who will have to sit in the room with the patient and stuff. I had never heard of anything like this.
And it's not necessarily all of the patient either. It's the family members sometimes too. You have to watch the family members because the family members are coming in acting up.
Yeah.
So it's all around. You got to watch all, both sides.
So what do you do in your position to be able to help these kinds of people?
So right now I'm in a position, I work for the Department of Veteran Affairs, and I'm what you call a program analyst, but also an education coordinator. So what I'm doing right now is working with all of our leadership and developing training programs to help our leadership. One of the in any organization, you get beat up on in middle management. You get hit from the top, you get hit from the bottom, but there's not a lot of tools to help our middle management a lot. So I'm developing a lot of tools to be able to help them. And then also too, I'm mentoring, I'm coaching leaders as well too, to make sure that they have that support. So I'm blessed to work in what we call the business office, which is a very small group, TID, Technology Innovation and Development. Small team, but a phenomenal team, and we're doing some very phenomenal work at the hospital.
Yeah, do you have like a 10-year plan for yourself? Like, where are you trying to go?
Yes, I'm actually trying to be an undersecretary for the VA, which is in DC, and so my goal is to get into an executive development program by the end of this year, beginning of next year, get to an AD position, associate director position, and then from there, manage my own hospital, and then from there, head on to DC to work on the policies.
Come on, Steve.
So that's the
Doctor Steve. Well, Doctor McCullough. We're gonna call it. You get up to that level, you don't get your first name goes away. I don't know what happens.
It's all good.
You're a humble guy, though. I mean, you know, you don't walk around saying, "Hey, everybody, I'm a doctor. I got this."
No.
You know, because we met through church. We're both members of the same church, Spear Church. Shout out Spear Church.
Most definitely.
And so, you're heavily involved with the men's ministry there.
Yes.
And most people, I bet you, if you ask most people, they don't know what you're up to at the hospital. You know what I'm saying? There's Dr. Steve. He's always there. He's reliable. He's trustworthy. He's got a good word every time, a good prayer, you know. But I think they'll be excited to hear some of this, you know, what you got going on in your life. But how do you manage? I can't believe that it's not a busy part of your life, being VA, doing all the things you're doing, and then trying to add on church. And then you said your wife for 37 years. I'm sure you have a wonderful family, right?
Yeah. So it's I keep myself busy, but I've always been that way. You know, my grandmother, she was a very busy person, and she passed that down to me.
Okay.
And so even at the age of, I think, about 81, she was on a Greyhound traveling all over the country.
Oh, really?
So that's how she was. Strong, strong woman. But for me, I even teach at Maryville University as well, too. So I teach business as
Steve,
a professor as well.
Steve, we got to take a break. Like, Saturday. You need a Saturday or something. I don't know. That's my wife's alma mater, Maryville.
Okay.
Go, what is it, the Saints, right?
Yeah. Oh, most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
So what are you teaching there?
So I'm teaching business there.
Okay.
So right now I'm teaching a supply chain management course and making sure. So I'm going to allude back to something that you said before. Right. One of the things about education, we as instructors need to make it more exciting for our students. And so because of experiences like you had and other students, my job is to make sure my students have meaningful assignments. I could care less about these basic assignments that are busy work.
Yeah.
I do things like I want my students to go interview a CEO within their industry. And I've had several students come back and say I got a job offer from an interview.
Yeah.
That's the kind of assignments our students need nowadays. Our old academic system is shifting and we need to shift with it. We try to get students off the phone. Let's just stop preaching, stay off your phone, and let's give them assignments that help them use the phone and teach them how to use it and balance the use for that. So we have to, as teachers, as trainers, as professors, we have to get better at making education not necessarily more fun, but more practical.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what I do in the university side.
I see that just on a smaller scale in my own family, right? So my kids, young kids, but they're obviously going to grow up with technology. It's everywhere. You know, we have not decided to limit their tablet use per se. You know, we want the, because look what their dad does. Like, you know, I'm on my computer 19 hours a day. You know what I'm saying? So it's, or some sort of video work or something, right?
Remember that
so,
commercial I learned about watching you?
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to want to do what I do, and I'm going to have to show them, and maybe they'll take to it, maybe they won't. But what I do notice is because they spend time learning in ways that I would have never thought they would learn.
Yeah.
So they watch they're drawn to all sorts of different types of videos, but sometimes, like my daughter's a great example of this. So she watches these YouTube videos where they like draw, and they show you how to like draw a butterfly or show you how to draw a thing. And so she'll go in the kitchen table, she has a real piece of paper, and she'll watch the video, and all of a
Sorry,
sudden
ruin it.
she's got. And I'm like, and so it's brought out a potential gifting in her. And the same thing for like crafts and stuff. Like they'll see an idea, like, you know, three levels of oil and what sinks and what doesn't. And all of a sudden they want to pull all the stuff out of my kitchen and they're doing this, but they're learning in a way that is practical to them on their level. Right. And so this is what you're saying. Let's not just put the phones away. What is a way they can use this phone that's practical? I absolutely believe that that's a thing for the Christian church too, is that we often like want to invite everybody to a Bible study, but really, like, what is that equipping us for? You know, we need to be equipped to be able to share the gospel via a podcast or via whatever the vehicle is. We've got to learn how to do these things on the level of technology that we're at today. I imagine that it's not an easy thing to do.
No.
So as you are in a place where you're trying to develop, you're on the side of developing the ways to do that. So what are some things that you're seeing in that development that are sticking?
So, giving them practical tools that they have the understanding of where this is going. If you've ever taken a course, which most people have, you take the assignment or you go throughout the course and you're just like, what am I going to need this for in the future?
Right.
A lot of people don't like math because they ask that question. Why are you having me doing all this math stuff? I'm not going to use it in the future.
That's right.
So let's, like my students right now, I'm teaching a supply chain management class. I tell my students, we have a blog that you have to do every single week. All these questions are based on supply chain management. The thing is, none of you all, matter of fact, I can say none, but a slim chance that you all are actually going to go into logistics in a supply chain field. I have cybersecurity, healthcare, human resource students. I have an accounting student. So turn the question into the perspective of what you're going to be doing in the future. So if you're an accountant, look at that question and say, what is an accountant worried about in this question? And then you give me an answer back. My students love this because of the fact that I'm just not telling them that you need to learn this and answer the question because that's what the book says.
Right.
No, they're applying it to what, because every business has logistics. It depends on what, I mean, even a small business, you got to go down to the post office and mail off stuff. So teach the students how this is going to apply to them in the future and make it make sense to them.
Yeah.
And you'll get more out of it.
I have this image of like all the good movies based around like a teacher came into a bad environment, you know, like what was that?
Michelle Joe Pfeiffer Clark.
And Coolio and
Dangerous,
you know,
Minds.
Yeah, yeah. And like there's tons of these, you know, and every single time the teacher Finding Forrester was another one where he taught the guy to write a book. Yes. And they come into a situation where it's not ideal for the students. Like they're either not being effectively taught, or maybe they're shining in other areas, but they're trying to be force fed to go down this other route.
Yes.
And each time you see this teacher, find a way to meet them on their level. And that's exactly what you're describing. And so like you're doing the typical movie like thing that provides the best results, the results we all want to see happen, you know? But we're not doing it in a typical way, because everybody fights against the typical way. Like in all these movies, right? They're like, you're doing it wrong. That's never going to work and all this. But it does work though.
And it's hard on teachers because, especially in the K-12 systems, because they're teaching now for these students to pass the test, because there's so many stipulations on them that their jobs are in jeopardy if their students don't pass these tests and make certain percentages, which is hard on them. But a big shout out to all our K-12 teachers, because that is a hard profession and you don't get paid a lot either.
Yeah.
So we have to support. And then also too, let me say this as well. Parents have to do a better job. And I think the good thing that came out of COVID was a lot of parents realize it's probably not the teacher's fault.
Yeah.
If your child was bad in the classroom and
really?
COVID, right.
I thought you knew.
And now you get to see. I used to laugh at some folks. They were like, I don't know why my kid's so bad. I'm like, the teacher's been telling you for the past 2 years, your child bad. Now he's at home because of COVID, and you get to see it. Now you got to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, don't blame it always on the teacher.
Yeah, no, the teacher. I'm blessed that we're able to send my kids to a private school. And it's been interesting because I see, like, they teach cursive, for instance. And the public schools gave that up at some
good,
point.
Good, thank you. Yes.
The good that they gave it up or good that they teach it?
If the power goes out,
yeah,
you cannot sign your name electronically. So they need to learn how to sign their name. I don't know why they're taking that out of schools.
Yeah, me neither. And so it's interesting to me to know that the way that they're being taught in the school is always Christ-centered and Christ-focused. And so obviously where you're at, that isn't always a thing. So how are we effectively teaching people who aren't like having a because some people aren't in school because they know that God's put a plan on their life. They've got a calling. They've got a gifting, and they're going out in the world to spread that out. You know what I'm saying? Some people are that's selfish, or they don't even know why they're at school. I would imagine most kids are at school just like going to school. So how do you, as a Christian in that environment, love on these kids in a way that hopefully teaches them to figure this out for themselves?
Man, let me tell you. It starts with the small things. The small things, as a student calls you for help, you call them back. Imagine how many kids at home don't have somebody to call them back, don't have somebody that's going to answer them or help them. That's the small stuff, and that's easy to do. But we, if you pass up on those opportunities, you will burn a bridge with a kid, and it's hard to get that back, because we have to realize that a lot of them don't, they didn't grow up in the same households that we grew up in. I was blessed to have two parents who understood that concept and reinforced those things through love and everything else.
Right.
So because I was blessed with that, it's my job to pass that on to someone else. So in the classroom, it's a matter of follow up with the student, check on them, send them an email and say, hey, how you doing? I just wanted to follow up. You did pretty well on this assignment, or you didn't do well on this assignment. What kind of help do you need? And when they ask you for help, you better be there to give them that help.
Trust. And so the technology side of it, though, is also, is that been a deterrent? Because what I my wife's brother is also a teacher in high school, and so he was explaining, like, basically everything's electronic now.
Yes,
everything, like, it's all Google Drive. They're submitting their projects, they're seeing everything online, there's not paper or anything. And so for me, I don't know if that's a hindrance or a help.
So people have to look outside of their own box. There are some people who do not have the means to have all the electronics at the home. So we're having teachers make assignments to say, hey, I need you to go home tonight, type this up. Okay, so what if the kid lives in an area that's not safe? They don't have electronics. They don't have internet at home. So therefore, it's kind of hard for them to do that assignment. It's not like when we grew up, you could go down to the library and stay all night in the library. There's some kids who live in some dangerous neighborhoods where they can't do that.
Yeah.
So either they can do it on their phone, and that's where the teachers have to be creative. If you can't go to a library or you don't have a computer at home, you have a phone, shoot me an email and send me your assignment through the email. So we just have to be more creative in the classroom.
How does that translate in terms of relational? Because it's like phone, text, and being there for somebody is one thing, but like there has to be something that's disconnected when you're not really looking somebody in the eye.
So relational, let's start with the work environment. The work environment, we have a lot of businesses who are going to this electronic only training. That bothers me so much, because we cannot build effective relationships if we're always on over the internet. We have to get people in the room to know how to work with each other. So we can couple those together. Don't eliminate both of them, but they have to be worked together. Now in academia, we have to teach them balance. We're shifting to, yes, we need to work with them electronically, but I need to teach a student how a balance. Turn your phone off.
Yeah.
You know, one of the CEOs I work for, Elena, I really commend her for, she said on Monday mornings, she told the whole company, on Monday morning, I don't want anybody looking at email until the afternoon. You come in as a leader and you talk to your folks in the beginning of the week. You see how they're doing. You talk to them. Don't talk to them about work. Just see how the weekend's doing, see how their families are doing. And then in the afternoon, go through your emails. Because you'll sit down, you know, on Monday morning, you got a million email. And you haven't built relationships with your employees from the very beginning. You're stuck in your office all day long reading emails over the weekend.
Now you're the boss everybody hates.
There you go.
Your relationships are out the window.
Exactly.
You're not going to be able to be effective as a boss or a communicator.
With my business students, I do this thing all the time. I tell them to close their eyes, and I do it in threes. So I say, close your eyes, and then have them open their eyes. And I say, no, 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 no. I say, do it again. And then they open up their eyes. I say, no, 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 no. And I'm pointing at each of them when I do this. And then the third time, I say, open up your eyes. And I smile and wave at them. And so I asked them, I said, what did you think was going to happen? And they said, we thought you was going to say no, no, no again. I said, why? They said, because every time we opened up our eyes, you said no. I said, that's how some of you do not want to be a leader. Because every time you come around, you're telling them no, they didn't do this right, they didn't do that, you know, all of that. And some supervisors and managers, that's what they look like to their employees. Yeah. And you can't do that.
Yeah. There's somebody I heard said it once, I repeat it often, you have to deposit more than you withdraw in people.
Yes.
And that is so easy to forget as a leader who needs to get things done on a deadline, and you've got people underneath you and they delegate and all this stuff. And the word can in front of hey, can you do this? Instead of, hey, do this. That's a whole, it's the same thing. Yeah. It's the same thing. I'm going to need you to do this. Can you do it? But it opens up a dialogue of relationship. Like, hey, I'm pretty busy. Oh, of course I can. I'll get that for you. But relationally, it's so much different than just no.
And visually, what you're saying is palm up versus palm down. If I'm pointing, my palm is down. Versus if I'm asking you a question, can you do that? My palm is up.
Yeah.
So we can do that verbally and we can do it visually as well, too. Makes a difference.
Yeah, sounds like you have really had some success in walking this out from your side. And so you wrote the book. Let's talk about this. Business. Let's talk about the title. Let's talk business teaching and training in churches. So you it sounds like you maybe have taken some of the lessons and applications from your secular world job and put it into training.
Correct.
The church.
So part of, I've been involved with ministry since, oh man, about 10 years old now.
Yeah.
I joined a camera crew to avoid singing in the choir.
Oh, yeah.
And back in the day, back in the 80s, if you got caught in the hallway in our church, next you know, you got a choir robe on, you singing in the choir.
Yeah, I went to a small family church, storefront church, before I came to the Spirit Church, and everybody was in the choir.
Yes.
Everybody's in the choir. Get up there. I don't care if you can sing or you get in that choir. And I was like, I don't know these songs. We didn't have a hymnal book or nothing. I was like, y'all got me. You got to pick somebody else. Like, I got to learn these songs. But by the end of it, I was like, all right, I got to know these songs now. But I get what you're saying. But the camera crew in the 80s.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Y'all had a camera ministry in the 80s.
Yeah. Our church, Bishop Jasper J. Phillips, very well-renowned pastor of the PAW, Pentecostal Assemblies of the World. He was a forward thinker, and above, forward, way beyond his time. And we developed a camera ministry. Brother Greg Cortland, he pulled myself and four other young kids in. While he had three other operators that were older, and he taught us how to do business. And I talk about that in the book, because we had meetings before we went out there. We took the cameras out before service started. So he taught us that. And then he would assign us what cameras. He taught us how to protect the cameras, how to take care of them, how to, you know, do all the white balance and all that kind of stuff. So he's teaching us, even though we're in middle school, he's teaching us how to do business. And then he would make you in charge and he would rotate that. So we're learning how to be leaders. And again, another forward thinking individual who's passing something along. And he worked, I think, for Warner Cable, which was a cable network in Cincinnati. And that's what he would do on the part time on Sunday, is come in and run our camera program. And so he still does it today.
So that led you on a road to writing this book.
So this was the business part of it. And then my dad has always been involved with committees and everything else. And so tagging along with him, my mom was a seamstress. She had her own business. She would do that in the basement. And so she taught me how to sew, and I would watch how she would go out and talk to clients. At 10 years of age, me and my dad got into an argument. And he always wanted me to wear a tie, and I hate wearing ties. So he said, he said the wrong thing to me in, as a kid. Yeah. If you don't like what I want you to wear, go get your own. And so he didn't realize my personality. Well, he did, but he just said it. So I went ahead and I got a lawnmower and I put two flashlights on it and I started cutting grass, and I made like $400 over the weekend and bought my own clothes. So instead of, and being a great dad that he is, instead of, you know, scolding me or anything like that, what he did was he encouraged me and he helped me put my own ad in the newspaper. So at 12 years old, when I did that, I had my first client who called and said, and I had my own lawn service for a little bit. So that was my first business at 12 years old. And my parents always encouraged with flashlights on there. I was out there.
So what did you buy instead of the suit with the tie?
So it's funny you asked that, because he always said he'll give us $20 towards any pair of gym shoes that we want. And I remember I wanted some Jordans, and I was like, man, I'll get some Jordans. So I remember he took me up to the store. And my dad is such a phenomenal teacher, because he didn't say, no, you're not going to do it. He always asked you a question. And he said, how much money you have on you? I said, $400. And he's like, wait, that's what you did, you know, to make that money. I mean, sorry, what did you do to make that money? I said, I was out there in the hot sun cutting grass all day long. So he said, at this point, I really want you to consider getting one pair of Jordans, or going over to this other store and getting some Nikes that are half price, and you can get some outfits to go with it. Because he didn't say no. And I remember just standing there like, if I buy them Jordans, that's half my money. And I get no. So I never bought Jordans as a kid. I would always go to Value City, TJ Maxx, everything else, and I would come home with like 10 outfits versus one pair of shoe. And so I appreciate him allowing us to learn that lesson early on.
That's a good lesson to learn, man, yeah. Because kids like to blow that money.
Yes.
My first paycheck, $110 from working at Chick-fil-A at 14, it went straight to Best Buy.
There you go.
I had 10 CDs on my shelf, and now those are in the dumpster somewhere in some place. Like, when we are kids, we will blow that money. If I could go back, Johnny, we could be a billionaire. This would spend it right.
Save and invest it.
Put 10 away. Put 10,
tie it. There you go.
Do something with it besides there what you're doing.
That's it, man. That's it.
So these lessons, they compiled, it sounds like, over time for you.
Yeah, and Bishop, he was a great businessman, and so we got to see a lot of different decisions he made. He was always supportive of young people, and so from there it started, you know, going. So that when I was in the military, traveled all around the world, lived in a lot of different states, went to a lot of different churches. So I got to compare how business was being done. There are several churches that I've taken a lot of notes from and had a great opportunities to see business done well, but then I've been to some churches who have not done it well. And it really bothered me where, when you think of the word excellence, are we really doing business in a term of excellence? And so that's where over 3 years I sat down and really put this book together to really look at, when we come to church business, are we doing it in excellence? And what I mean by that is, my job outside of church, if I'm showing up on time, I'm doing everything I'm asked to do, I'm getting promotions, I'm there 100% of the time, I'm working overtime and everything else, but then it comes to church and I'm always late. Yeah. I'm never putting my best foot forward. I'm always complaining and everything else. I'm not doing that on my outside job. Now, when it comes down to what is going to last, is it this outside job or what I do for God is going to last? And I really had to take a introspective look at myself and say, what am I doing wrong? We used to sing a song in church, he's an all-time God, yes he is. But we started church late.
I've been in a lot of churches. It's church time.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
When is this going to get going?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, business meetings to me, I've always had a problem with business meetings because, you know, in the corporate sector, you know, I can take every single salary of every single person in the room. I can divide it up, do some math calculations, and I can tell you how much your meeting's worth.
Yeah.
And if you need to have this meeting or not. So a lot of times when I sit in business meetings, I think of the effectiveness of this meetings. If I go through your minutes and I see that you've listed several things on there, I'm going to ask, when have you completed these things? So there are several churches that I went to that I can say I looked at those lists and they were on it. We're going to knock this out. We're going to finish this. We did this. And then with next meeting, we're going to add three more things. I've been to some churches where they've never accomplished anything that's on that list. They don't even have minutes. Yeah. And I have a problem with that.
So when people think of business in the church, explain what this means, because they're going to get caught up. Like, church is not a business. Yeah. What does that mean?
Oh, but it is. And the thing I like to tell people a lot of times is, when Mary and Joseph supposedly lost Jesus when he was about 10, they finally found him and he was in the church.
That's right.
And there are several different verses on it, but for the New King James Version, it says that when they found him, he said, basically, I'm paraphrasing, I was about my father's business.
Right.
So therefore, even at a young age, he understood that this is business. So what happens is, and there, I have to clarify.
Oh, don't listen too sharply, those who are critics of this, because that might hurt a little bit.
I have to clarify this, because a lot of times when folks are saying we need to not so much think of church as a business, I have to really look at the psychology of this, meaning where is their feelings towards business from their experience? When we talk about business in the church, we're supposed to be better than what we're doing outside. So if you've been hurt in businesses outside of church, if you've worked for corporations or companies that just don't do it well, don't bring that in the church. Because you have a lot of backbiting, you have, you know, politics and everything else. Don't bring that in the church. We're supposed to be better. And so that's where, yes, we still got to pay taxes. We still have to do a whole bunch of other things. Even with the tax exemption status and everything else, there's still things that go on business-wise. Jesus had an accountant with him a reason, you know, because he understood business. So having a physician and having entrepreneurs who understood business, people really need to take a look at those 12 disciples and really think about what they did for a living and think about what they brought to the table. They knew business.
Yeah, all of them did.
Yes.
For the most part, fishermen, tax collectors, you know, we got accountants and all these other things, you know, going on, that these guys understood what it was like, and I'm sure they applied it in their ministries.
Exactly.
And so here we are today, like nothing's changed.
No.
Like we've got people who work in business world who also work in churches. Churches aren't a business in the terms of that we're selling you a product.
Exactly.
You know, but it can be run in a way that it allows us to be excellent and provide a good service, for lack of good ministry.
Yes.
You know, if you want to replace the term. But so what is it in this book that we're going to learn in terms of how to do that?
So the key thing about this book is the title is Conversation Starter. I was very careful of picking this because I don't want people to feel by any means that I'm trying to tell them how to run their church,
yeah,
how to do things a certain way. It's literally, in order to make effective change, you have to start with a conversation. And so this is just me putting my thoughts out there to literally get folks to start having a conversation about business within their churches. Again, very particular about not telling people you should do this, you should do that, but start having the question, are we really doing things to a level of excellence? Are we showing up on time to our meetings? Are we effectively training folks, or are we just throwing them out there? A lot of churches that are small churches have to be really careful of, when they grow, having certain people in certain positions. I helped start a church, and I've seen you pick auntie to take care of the books,
yeah,
when you got five people in your church, and your storefront church, now you got 20 people. Auntie's still okay,
yeah,
because she's the only one. She's never had any HR experience, mm-hmm, doesn't have any experience with finances, but because she's auntie, she's the only one you have. Boom, next you know, you have 2,000 members. Auntie's not qualified.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I love auntie as much as you want to, but at the same time, unless auntie has gotten the training, and I'm not necessarily going to say go to school, but unless she's gotten the proper training to manage that type, that is not a bit good business, I'm going to say policy, but a good business outcome to have.
Right.
You need to have people who are qualified.
You wouldn't, but people have get hung up, like, I don't want to fire my friends, my family. And a lot of churches, especially new church plants, are often family members.
Yes. Yeah.
So you got to struggle through that. And so, and a lot of people have a heart to start a church, and they're on fire for God, and God's called them to start a church, but they're not built up as leaders who are effective trainers necessarily.
Correct.
They might be great speakers and great effective evangelists,
yeah,
but when it comes to training a staff on how to, you know, operate the machinery and get the thing going that you need done, you know, worry about the lawnmower that needs to get turned on and all that kind of stuff, they might be ill-equipped.
Yeah.
So I definitely, you know, yeah, I've been to, I don't know, maybe a dozen churches or so in my church life. And so I've seen ebbs and flows of all of them, you know. And so something like this is effective, I'm sure, if people take it serious. But I'm just not sure if walking, like a lot of people are not looking for answers because they don't know if anything's, they don't know that nothing's broken.
Yeah.
They don't,
yeah,
realize it.
Unless you have, now the Bible talks about all the gifts are in the house. So I promise you, inside the house, the gifts are there to be able to have people that will be able to look. My experience, let me define two things first. Number one, the biggest confused concepts in business is leadership and management.
Okay.
People get those two things confused all the time. Just because you're telling people what to do does not make you a leader.
That's right.
Leaders inspire,
yeah,
versus managers tell people what to do. So that concept has to be dispelled first for people to understand where they fall into that spectrum. Next, they really have to understand what the difference is between teaching and training. Now, I have 10 years of experience as a teacher, teaching at a university in colleges. And then on the other end of it, I've taught and trained in the corporate sector as well, too. Teaching and training are two different things. Teaching, you're laying the foundation. When it comes to training, you're training people off of the foundation. So you have folks who have never been taught, and you're trying to train them, but they don't ever have a foundation. So those two things are the concepts that really need to be looked at when we talk about leadership development programs.
Yeah, interesting. So they know the what to do, but not necessarily the why.
Exactly.
Right. So, and you see this in churches a lot where you're growing fast and I just need a cameraman. Just do like this with the thing and press this button when we need, like, but they don't understand, like you said, you learned how to do the white balance and everything else. So
yes,
that is a different foundation that you have than just saying, hey, hold this, hold, and point it at the person who's talking.
Exactly.
You know? It's a different thing.
Exactly. You'll have folks who are very excited, and we don't want to lose that excitement.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is we want to make sure that we are training our folks properly. If you have to bring folks in who have the experience, so they can sit down and learn from them. I was talking to a manager this past week, and I asked the question of, do you know how to do an interview? And she said, not really. I said, okay, this is what I want you to do. I'm not going to tell you to go read a book on how to interview. I want you to pick two people that you know that are phenomenal at doing interviews. And I want you to ask them if you can sit down with them and watch how they do their interviews and get a literally upfront and close lesson on how to do interviews. And I remember she said, I have two people in mind, and that's what she's going to do. So hopefully I'll hear back from her next week on that. But we have to train people in different, and people learn different.
Yeah.
Some people I can give a book, they can read it and they're good. Some people are like, I don't need a book, I just need to see it. Yeah. And then I'm good from there. So we have to see how these people learn as well too.
What do you see, you know, as some problems that sort of led to the creation of this that you were like, this is something tangible that we can talk about?
The biggest thing for me is the effectiveness of meetings. I think a lot of times, especially in our electronic age, we call a lot of meetings, and the meetings a lot of times are ineffective. So the first thing is, what is an effective meeting? An effective meeting is if we meet on something, we're going to have next steps. And then are those steps followed, first of all, but what is the outcome afterwards? So if I can take a look at your minutes and say, you said that you wanted to do these three things. The first thing is I'm going to look at, do you have a deadline of when these things should be done? And then the next thing is the accountability. Who's going to be doing it? A lot of times that's the first phase where people fail, first of all.
It's already over.
Exactly. They don't have a timeline and they don't have the accountability. So you get to the next meeting and you already know what it's going to look like, because the next person looking at the next person saying, I thought you was going to do it.
Yeah.
You didn't clarify that in your meeting before. So you're already setting up for failure in your meeting. Now, it's like if you keep on losing the battles, you're going to lose the war. So if you keep on having ineffective meetings, you're going to have an ineffective program.
Yeah. Because most people think you just show up to church, pastor preaches a sermon and all this, but there's a lot more to it. We got to consider, how are we going to run the prayer meeting? How are we going to build the kids ministry? How are we going to have Easter Sunday when we got 16 food trucks at Spirit Church? And like, these are the conversations all sorts of people have to have across the country in their churches.
Yes.
And so you're saying the meeting, and I can see that, because I've had my fair share. I've both worked in a church. I've been in small churches. I've been part of leadership, volunteers at every level. Yeah. So I've been in all types of different meetings of just serving in the church, at whatever level I've been at. And I have seen over and over again, I wouldn't be able to pinpoint like you did, but I have seen the ineffectiveness of meetings. And so many times I've been into a meeting, well, that was pointless. Like 2.5 hours later, I'm like, we're talking about stuff that wasn't even supposed to be talked about.
Yes.
And then you open up to questions, and all of a sudden we're here an hour longer and you're asking pointless questions, in my opinion, right? And it could be vice versa, right? Like, I might ask something and you're like, what does that have to do with anything? So what do we do? You got to get the minutes out. You got to get the,
So I'll say it this way. If we look at Jesus as a model, okay, the first thing is look at how he structured activities. There's a point in time where he was like, nope, I'm just taking y'all three. Everybody else, you have something else to do. So within that lesson in itself, which we call an ad hoc meeting, everybody doesn't need to be there.
Yeah.
You need to choose strategically who you're going to choose for this particular assignment, and then go ahead and grab those individuals and get it done, and then report back to the group. So that is an effective. We don't need everybody in there when everybody doesn't need to be involved, because you start muddying the water and you don't have clarity on what's going on. So that's one example. Another example is making sure that we are training on how to have meetings. That's the first thing. We just can't start saying, here, I want you to be in charge and I want you to have a meeting. No. First of all, the pastor is the CEO. At this point, we need to have an effective training program to where, and I say this in the book, if you have a problem with the pastor showing up, I don't think you need to be in that position. Because as a teacher, the principal's job is to pop in on classes to make sure the classroom is going properly and things are being done. So even with training programs, if the pastor pop up and want to see your notes on what you're teaching on, you better have those notes. Because that's their job, to be able to do that, to make sure that we're still lining up, number one, with the Word of God.
Yeah.
And then whatever's being preached on Sunday, those classrooms and what's going on training wise needs to be lined up as well too. And so that is a critical component. But number one, pastors have to be taught how to do it.
Yeah.
But then two, the trainers and the teachers need to be taught what they need to give the pastor in order to be able to make that effective.
Yeah. The problem is that the people who are called into ministry are not always effective administrators.
Exactly.
We didn't go to school and learn how to do a office logistics like you're teaching in your class today. You know what I'm saying?
So again, the gifts in the house, I promise you. Matter of fact, I did this for one church. If you take a look at the problems business-wise, there are people who, for a regular, they're outside business that are doing it every single day. I need you to step up
yeah.
and help out. So if you have, and I'm just going to give this example. One of our meetings, we had an individual who owned his own car shop. Okay. He'd been a mechanic his whole entire life, never been on the corporate sector, but he's phenomenal at what he does. He's in charge of a meeting, but he doesn't know how to run meetings because the most he's ever had is three people for his meetings. Okay. And they haven't been formalized meetings. Yeah. Just come yeah. on together and we'll talk. So we have an individual in the church who works for as a corporate executive. You come to church every day, or maybe every Sunday, and you're not doing anything in the church at all, but you're complaining because the business is not being effective.
Yeah.
Okay. You've been gifted with an opportunity to learn how to run meetings because you do that on your regular job. Why don't you take your gifts and help out?
Yeah.
And share on how to properly have a meeting and help everybody else out and share our gifts with each other.
It's that you're right. What I've seen over the course of being in all these different churches is that there's always a call on the congregation to stand up and serve. Come on, guys, we'll have a whole Sunday yes. dedicated to why we serve and all this. And what I've seen time and time again is that people don't ultimately, like, there are people who will step up. But when you're in a church full of people where everyone should stand up,
yes,
and 10% of us are standing up to serve, that's an issue.
The Pareto rule.
What's that mean?
20% of the people do 80% of the work.
Yeah, yeah, the yeah. 8 and 2. So that's an issue, though. That's yeah, that's yeah. You know how yeah. you said the gifts are in the house. They sure are.
They are.
You know that the CEO who can lead meetings and the mechanic who can help fix the cars and all this different stuff. But if they're not going to stand up, so we have to be able to build them up to a way. And I have not seen the church who's effective at it.
So let me say this. I've seen two churches who are effective at it. The example, now again, I'm very careful of saying, especially for best practices, that everything fits in each other church. But in these effective ministries, what they did was they had a job board and they listed what was needed on those boards and they listed the duration of when they were needed. So folks, a lot of times if you ask folks to volunteer for stuff and they don't like volunteering, they feel like if they volunteer one time, then they're going to be locked into something. And so therefore they don't step up. But if I say, let's back on the example I was saying before, we need someone who's has experience on the corporate level, who knows how to run meetings, to come in and teach us a 30-minute class on how to run meetings. That's the duration, 30 minutes. You open it up to, number one, I'm telling you the opportunities, but then I'm giving you the time frame. Can you support for 30 minutes? Most people can, versus haha, surprise, you're now in charge of this
yeah,
program.
Yeah. I think that's the trick, though. I think everybody's been around church long enough. If I do that, they're going to ask me to do the next
exactly,
thing.
Exactly.
And you get people serving it. Like, because what you're describing is a perfect situation where someone is called in to do something that they're gifted to do yeah. and trained other people to do it. More oftentimes we see in the church, we just need help in the nursery. We just need help slopping the food down during the potluck or whatever, you know, like, so people are not walking in the areas that God has gifted them and called them to do. That's why I think it's so important for people to understand what their gifting is.
That's it.
You have to find out, like, you learned your mercy gift. That's how you're able to walk out a path where you're doing it for not only for a living, but being able to teach and train people to, you know, have compassion and care for their church too, you
yes.
know? So
yes.
It's so important.
It's, I look at it, this is a ministry as well. God has gifted me with an administrative skill set
clearly
to yeah. be able to help out and look at how we can sharpen business. And it's, I do it from the standpoint of I do it in the hospital. So therefore I'm using my gifting that I use outside the church within the hospital. I mean, within the church as well too.
Yeah. Let everybody know how they can pick up your book or website if they want to talk to you about setting up their church with stuff.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. So my website is stevemccullough.com. You can even Google it, and then it'll come up, and then the book information's on there. It's on Amazon. It's published through Dorrance Publishing, so you can go to Dorrance as well, too. But just come to the website, and then you'll see all the leadership development stuff that I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys. Well, thanks for watching today's episode of the podcast with Dr. Steve Emanuel. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You, too, as well. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we'll have to catch up again once you got the podcast studio up and all the stuff you got planned for your future, too.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
All right, guys. Thanks for watching today. We're going to have links in the description for the book. Dr. Steve, you go pick it up. Until next time, we pray you discover a future and a hope for your life today. We ain't trying to blend in. If you're ready, come on with us, my friends. Come on. We can change the world. Hey, hey. Let's go. What changes the world? The only thing that ever really changes the world is when somebody gets the idea that love can abound and can be shared.